Notes on the Intersection of Art and Belief was presented by Wes Hurd on October 23, 2004, at the 2004 Oktoberfest conference titled An Anniversary Medley. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
The title to this talk is Notes on the Intersection of Art and Belief. And the reason I titled it that way is because my life has been so utterly slammed the last 3 months that I knew if I didn't give myself some room to maneuver around that I would have a difficult time. So that's the logic behind the title. Actually, some years ago, we invited a biblical scholar, a wonderful man named Walter Kaiser, to come to the study center and deliver some talks on studying the Bible. And he was famous for his titles on his books, which were always titled Towards A, Theology of, Towards A. And I think that we have affectionately adopted that title. At least that's the spirit behind my idea of the notes on art. My talk tonight is going to be about three things. I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about what I think art is. Let's see. How many of my freshman practicum people are here? The whole freshman practicum at Gutenberg is built on the question of what is art. They have to write a definition. So there aren't too many here, so we should be okay, except for Tegan. She's here. You can't tell, Tegan. I've titled it Notes on the Intersection of Art and Belief, basically because I want to explore the idea or the notion or the phenomenon, rather, of how does art show belief? How does art demonstrate or manifest someone's ideas or thoughts or sensibilities or whatever it is that art does? How does it do it? And these are notes in the sense that they're also explorations on my part. I'm just sort of moving my way towards some conclusions about this, and I want to share where I am at this point, but I am in no way claiming to have tied this all down or have tight expertise on the subject. I think it's a fascinating and worthy subject, and since this is the Oktoberfest that we have designated a celebration of the 25th year of the Study Center and the 10th year of Gutenberg, we were all given freedom to choose the topics that we could work on, and so you're stuck with me on art. So, again, what is the topic here that I want to explore? One of the basic definitions of art is, or one of the most basic definitions of art is, idea taking form. And this would include, in my notion, the idea of beliefs, or sensibilities, or the things that we hold as knowledge, things that we view as true. If that's an acceptable, even if it's an all too abbreviated definition of art, my topic is, how does art manifest ideas? How does that work? Because art is different than other kinds of communication. I want to make a few background comments. Modern society today, contemporary society, views artists in a variety of ways, from being fairly harmless, if eccentric, and a little impractical. That is, unless they make money. If you make money, then it's okay to be an artist. They can be viewed as being fairly harmless. They can be viewed as being purveyors of social chaos and disintegration, being demigods or visionaries of culture who create new visions and possibilities for mankind, all these things. Given the character and nature of our present-day postmodern culture, it can without doubt be said that arts culture, primarily I'm thinking of music and cinema and film, the popular forms of those, as well as the more fine art forms of those, hold the power to move and shape and influence the masses today, the public, in ways that we could hardly have imagined 100 years ago. We have become a society where images and sound, often in what we call bytes, not words, create and define our vocabularies and our styles of consciousness and the boundaries of our social-cultural dialogues. That's all a kind of a academic way of saying or philosophical way of saying that arts have a lot of control today. And a lot of us are increasingly aware of that. This being the case, those who hold the power of art, who control art, who make art, and who create those images and sound bites hold a significant influence and power among us. The case for Christian involvement in participation in the world of the arts is interesting and complex. 30 years ago, it can be fairly said, I think, that there was virtually no significant evangelical Christian attention or presence in the arts. Not significant, at any rate. That changed, starting with the ministry of Francis Schaeffer and his colleague Hans Ruckmacher, through the influence of their writings and the ministry of LaBrie in Europe and the U.S. and Canada, Christians were prodded to rethink their lack of attention and participation in art. Schaeffer, Ruckmacher, and a handful of lesser knowns, mostly from the Dutch Reformed Christian tradition, interestingly, through their writings and speaking, found a ready, willing, and arts-hungry audience among the burgeoning numbers of young evangelical believers of the 60s and 70s. In effect, these young believers were being given permission by Schaeffer and Ruckmacher and others to become artists, painters, sculptors, writers, poets, dancers, composers, musicians, filmmakers. These developments over the years led to a continuing and growing Christian involvement in art making, culminating over the last 10 years in scores, if not hundreds, from my observation, of arts-related Christian organizations, fellowships, and a much larger recognition of the legitimacy and role of art in the life of the church. Though the church's participation in the arts has grown enormously, the growth has often been limited to those arts that can be utilized in liturgy or worship services, missions, evangelism. In other words, it's those arts that can be somehow most immediately applicable to some very specific agenda of the churches. Music, video, theater, all these things are tools in the hands of a growing number of churches, especially as they have defined what they mean by worship. Unfortunately, this utilitarian arts perspective of the church, as it has done other subjects related to our basic createdness and our basic creaturely humanness, completely misses the truth that our biblically based understanding of our calling to enjoy the Lord, to rejoice in the things of God, inevitably and unavoidably includes the various kinds of joys and satisfactions that God has built into the warp and woof of normal human life and existence in this world. There are many joys and satisfactions, but art and aesthetic satisfaction is one of them. It is not the greatest, it is not the least, but it is one of them. Evangelical Christianity has been poor at best and horrible at worst in its exclusion of and lacking and lack of valuing many of the very human things that God has given us and built into us in the name of piety. Not just art, but a whole fabric of cultural issues of being in the world, being a creature who's wired to be and made to be in this world, connected to this world. Nicholas Walterstorff in his book makes Art in Action makes the observation that there are many, many artists, and I've talked with many people who are not artists, not full-time artists, amateurs, people who just enjoy art making, who are really puzzled by this kind of disconnect on the part of our spirituality and understanding of the things of the Spirit and the righteousness and the pursuit of God, the disconnect of those things to the things that they really enjoy about life, funny little things like paint, clay, enjoying the design of something, the very color, shape, sound, not just the content of the art, materials that we make art from, somehow, when you talk to someone who is an artist or an art maker, it's the very materials they work with that they're often drawn to and wired to. Even though there's been a growing participation in the arts on the part of Christians in the church, Christians have, more often than not, they've had to put an emphasis on art and not on theology and not on a biblical pursuit of theology. What do I mean? Just that my experience with Christian groups formed for the purpose of encouraging and facilitating art making are inevitably made up of artists coming from a variety of denominations and traditions. If the art group focused on biblical and theological distinctives and the inevitable differences that would arise, and not on art, their fellowship would basically fall apart. Therefore, pragmatically, the vast majority of these art groups, actually defocus theology, defocus on the pursuit of biblical truth and interpretive differences about what the Bible is saying. Even the nature of the gospel itself is simply washed over in order to stay together to work on art. And I think that's a real tragedy. From an arts practice standpoint, it's understandable. And even in a certain perspective, I would say there's a certain amount of that would be okay. In my view, though, it's an unfortunate reality that in some cases waters down a vital exploration and dialogue, or exploration of and dialogue around significant biblical truth, or it removes it altogether. Again, in my view, this results often in a thin reflection on substantive Christian thought, important Christian thought, important Christian truth, and dialogue about that truth, its meaning and refining of it, our understanding of it. And as a result, all the deliberations and that energy and focus and the very things that Jack was talking about in his previous talk are not going to show up in the art. The art itself then gets thinned out because the thinking about art itself and the biblical theology behind a Christian artist becomes thin, and it results inevitably in the art. And I think maybe with where I'm going, you can see how that happens. Maybe. Now, I've mentioned these things to provide a little context for sharing some of my thoughts about the artist's experience of making art. That any artist, not just a Christian artist. As a very part-time artist myself, I've dabbled in the challenge that every artist, and certainly every Christian artist, faces of deciding several critical issues for myself. They are, what is art? How do you make art? Is there such a thing as Christian art? What makes it Christian? What does it or should it look like when Christian beliefs are the driving motivation behind the content of one's art? What kind of art do I want to make and why? Who is the audience for my art and why? In this very brief talk, I can't begin to touch on all those topics, and I would not attempt so. But let me share a few thoughts about how I think about what art is and how I think about how art works, at least at this point. Maybe in the question and answer period afterwards we can explore some of these things that I leave out. And I will leave chunks out. I just, it's not possible. This is a really complex and dense subject. So let me continue with my main topic tonight, just to reiterate that, to restate it. I'll put it in the form of a question. How does art manifest beliefs? What does that process look like? What happens at what I am calling the intersection of art and belief? And I'm going to do this in basically 3 points. I want to talk about, just very briefly, I'll just say a few things about what is a belief. What do I mean by that? And then I want to spend more time on what I think art is, because I think in exploring and defining art for oneself, it becomes clear the role that believing and human thought plays in art. So I'll spend some time talking about what art is. And then thirdly, I want to talk about how art is made, that is the process itself, and share just a few things from my own experience about that. First, a few thoughts about what is a belief. A very homespun definition. A belief is a piece of knowledge that a person's holds to be true. We all know generally what a belief is, commonsensically, and we know what beliefs are. I just want to point out a couple of things. Beliefs can exist and do exist at a known articulate level, at a conscious level, cognitive level. We often talk about beliefs around Christian circles like this. We often talk about these as beliefs being packaged in what we call a worldview. We talk about what a person believes, and we identify that as a worldview. A worldview answers questions like, and contains beliefs in answer to the questions, what is real? What is valuable? What is good? What is bad? How and why do I believe these things? The answers to these questions that I have. Maybe I don't have answers. These are beliefs that I hold consciously. At least at some level, I've articulated these to myself, and I can call them my worldview. There's another set of beliefs or category of beliefs that I'll just simply call taken for granted beliefs. They're beliefs that are not necessarily, I haven't really brought them up to the surface and examined them, but they're there nonetheless. What am I talking about? They're below the surface. They're things like, how fast should I live my life? It's kind of a funny question. But we all have a belief about that because we operate at a certain pace of life. A belief like, the most efficient way to live life is the best way to live life. Efficiency. I could hold that at a level in my beliefs, at a level that I haven't really brought it up and thought about it. Here's an example of that. A funny question. How big should refrigerators be? Now, some of you have been around me enough to know my story about the first time I went out of my culture. I went into English culture, into London in the early 70s. And back in those days, it's changed. Back in those days, the Brits had little fridges. And the first time Carol and I walked into our flat, I walked into the kitchen, and I was really quite happy with the place we were going to move into for a couple of years. And I looked around, and I noticed a little white box in the corner, and I thought, oh, they have a dishwasher. And then the next time I walked in, I realized, that's not a dishwasher. What is that? And I walked over, and I opened it. It was a refrigerator. It was this high. It was that wide. I was totally stunned. Refrigerators aren't that big. Refrigerators are this big. So here was a taken-for-granted belief that I held about how big refrigerators should be. We also hold beliefs about ourselves that are hidden from us in a sense. They're down below the surface. They're subterranean beliefs, images and pictures that we have of ourselves that we haven't articulated. So there are lots of beliefs that we have. Some of them are conscious, articulate, things that we can talk about and argue over. Other things are below the surface. And the reason I point this out is because both kinds of beliefs show up in art. Now, what is art? Art is a reflective, responsive statement. And I'll put that in quotes, statement. Manifesting an intensely focused observation and response about man and his experience in the world through the eyes of the art maker. Let me unpack that a little bit. Art comes from a kind of reflection on the world, on the self, on human experience, on observations in the world. It's a person's intelligent reception of information about the world and a response to it. Art includes that. Usually what happens is that a person, once having perceived, taken in, and responded at some level, there's an observing, there's a responding. All the way from looking at a photograph of the experience of nature, the Grand Canyon, a great thunderstorm. I was driving up River Road the other day, and the cloud formations that appeared through my windshield were just amazing. I just all of a sudden my attention was just captured by this panorama of a variety of different kinds of clouds and how they were layered, stacked in dark and light against each other. From the grand to the small, I have a new grandchild, and I was noticing the other day how she moved her little finger. She's 5 months old, and my attention was just focused on the beauty, on her beauty, and just the movement of that hand. Art takes in all those things. A person who is, and not just artists, obviously human beings, we all take this stuff in. Artists are the kind of people who want to do something with that. I described art as a statement. What I mean by that is that it's a kind of speaking that is different than normal, ordinary discourse. It can be words, as in poetry or literature. It often is images or objects or sounds or movement. In other words, statements, what I mean by the statements is that these are things that are extruded from me in a manner of speaking, a manner of saying something, a manner of communicating, but they can be different kinds of things. And they're always unique to the individual. Art always has this imprint, this fingerprint on it and in it, embedded in it, of that individual person. And that's part of the fun of music and poetry and visual imagery and things, that it always moves, it always has the mark of the maker in it, a certain, and it's kind of like a signature. So art translates out of an inarticulate, inner subjective world into a humanly recognizable form, these kinds of statements that I'm referring to. It requires the art maker's effort to crystallize and control his or her deep introspection, and that introspection then gets fabricated out into words and movement and art and images, various kinds of statements. George Steiner, who's written a wonderful little book, it's absolutely a delight, even though it's a difficult thing to read. It's one of those books that it's amazing. He said this: "We lack the right word for the extreme energizing and governance of instinct, for the ordered enlistment of intuition used by the art maker." In other words, we have a difficult time, and that's what I'm doing tonight, having a difficult time talking about how art gets made, where it comes from, what is it like. It's very hard to describe. I'll just make a mention of the fact that I've just started to look a little bit at Michael Polanyi's, some of his work on metaphor, and I'm fascinated by the possibility, and I think this is really has some real explanatory power, to think about art as metaphor, all art as metaphor. Metaphor, of course, is a statement or an image or a phrase or something that is like something else and by which we understand something else by looking at this metaphor. For example, a metaphor is, in one kind of metaphor that Polanyi talks about, he talks about the two parts of a metaphor, like Juliet is a sun. The two parts, Juliet, I'm not sure how he's using these terms exactly, but Juliet he refers to as the tenor, and the sun is the vehicle. But these two elements, these two parts of the metaphor, he suggests, create a mental image that does not only describe something, Juliet is the sun, is a sun, but it creates a new picture from the imaginative and intelligent integration that our minds do when we put the metaphor together and we use the metaphor. It creates and describes in a new way. It carries a metaphor can carry propositional and cognitive content through which we can gain a fresh perspective on something. It evokes, metaphor often evokes an intense emotional involvement, while at the same time not excluding cognitive propositional truth kind of involvement. And in Polanyi, interestingly enough, those of you that read him, a metaphor carries the speaker or the maker of the metaphor, carries their intention, their shared beliefs and assumptions in a way that only persons can create metaphors and take in metaphors. It's a very a wonderfully intelligent, creative process that implies personhood in the biblical sense. A lot of interesting implications of that, I think. The bundle of ordered thought and feeling that is found in a metaphor and in art is not irrational, it's rational. And it is irreducible at the same time to being expressed only in propositional or pragmatic reckoning. The metaphor kind of stands there and does its thing, and when we take it in, what it accomplishes, you can't accomplish in any other way, and you can't reduce it. You cannot maintain the power of the metaphor by taking it apart. It just stands on its own. And art has some very similar, I would argue, has some very similar kinds of effects and powers. I'm continuing my definition of art here, but maybe a couple of notes here on the overhead would be helpful. It seems to me that in trying to sum up, that art, we say art is idea, and that or belief, taking form at its very core and at its simplest. I would say that another way to put it, in my own way of thinking about it, is art is, from a Christian perspective, it is our humanness speaking. It is our humanness speaking. It's one way that we say things. It's one way that we communicate. It's a peculiar and particular way that we communicate. I would argue that humanness that speaks is rational in two different ways. It can be cognitive, that is conscious, propositional in nature. It can also be intuitive, That rationality shows up, again, in sort of the Polanyian sense, shows up as in our intuition, in the subterranean kinds of thinking, thinking that happens below the surface, like the famous example of being able to, having the knowledge of being able to ride a bicycle. You can ride a bicycle, but you can't explain in detail in propositional terms exactly how to ride that bicycle. It's a knowledge that is tacit, he calls. So it sort of exists in a person at a level that's what I'm calling intuitive here. It also is affective, and what I mean by that is it can contain deep human emotion and passion. Often we think about art as being primarily about passion or about strong feelings or a strong response, and that's really true. But a lot of contemporary art over the last 20 years has really moved away in some respects from that. It has become very conceptual and very philosophical, and a lot of people don't like that. But the fact of the matter is, it's both, I would argue. And then this emerges in what I'm calling a special language. It's a language that we call on that goes beyond normal discourse and takes form in the kinds of things that I've been talking about earlier. Sound, voice, music, instruments, movement. It can even take form by creating spaces in architecture and design. So it's a special kind of language that we draw on when we have a need to draw on it. And that special language can, the special languages of art are a kind of, I'm calling them a kind of vocabulary. They're different kinds of vocabularies, or even we might say dialect. There are varieties of those things. And then just one last thought, and that is that often art can be described as being allusive. That is, its power is, as in the case of the metaphor, indirect, takes the form of a symbol sometimes, or an analogy or something like that, but it's more open and indirect. It kind of points at things instead of being explicitly articulate. Again, George Steiner makes the comment in his great little book also that art can be and is often or implies that it is a critical act. Art making is a critical act. What could we mean by that? Well, he argues that in the sense of Matthew, what he refers to Matthew Arnold's phrase, that art is a criticism of life. Whether it's realistic or fantastic or utopian or satiric, the construct of the artist is a counterstatement to the world. That is, art is the embodiment of concentrated, selective interactions between what the artist observes about man, about the world, about the human condition, and the boundless possibilities of the artist's imagination. There's this tension, there's this breakdown. I see the world, and in Solomon's terms, there's this eternal reality in me that yearns for something, desires, speaks, wants to speak about something, wants to gain something. There's a kind of quest for something, and it shows up in the art. Okay. How is art made? It seems to me that art is made in at sort of two levels. The first level is a coming together of three things. The artist must involve himself in the control of a craft or a medium, the control and the artisanship of being able to control a medium, Again, it could be visual art, painting, drawing, it could be photography, it could be video, it could be dance, movement, it could, whatever the medium is, the artist by necessity has to engage in that medium and become a master, or move toward becoming a master in that medium. Secondly, the artist, there's a manifestation of that particular individual's personal vision, their personal vision of life. There's an emergence or a manifestation of a vision of life that comes out distinctively. It's that fingerprint. It's that unique signature that shows up in the work, regardless of the content, regardless of the subject matter. It's that unique artist's signature, as I've been saying. And then thirdly, the artist, I think, to become a serious pursuer of the mastery of an art form, there has to be an engagement in the history of the conversation of that art. Every art form has a history, and especially when it comes to what we call the fine arts or the high arts, usually fine arts or high arts have to do with, just sort of off the top, two things. One is they have to do with an amazing mastery, and that is, you're pursuing the mastery of the craft and the medium and the control of the medium and your ability to use the medium to say what you want to say. And then secondly, usually high or fine art has a serious intention regarding its content. It isn't just for decoration, which is legitimately art. It isn't just the design of packaging for something or in fashion or something. High or fine art is usually associated with a message, with the messages that man wants to speak or wants to explore. So all three of those things, the control of the medium, the personal vision, and the conversation with the history of that particular medium and that art form, that fine art form, is involved. Second, is that taking a thought, art is taking a thought, a belief, a sensibility, or all of those things in some mysterious connection to each other, and extruding it through the creative imagination. And as I mentioned, I think this is both a conscious process and an unconscious, or it comes from a kind of subterranean intelligence that God has built into being made in the image of God. That kind of unique specialness of being a person made in the image of God. So it's taking that thought, that sensibility, that belief, extruding it through the subterranean creative intelligence, and then choosing or finding a form, a word, a mark, a photo frame, a movement, a sound that forms an image that's appropriate to what that artist wants to say. It's appropriate to the artist's vision and his intention and the occasion that the artist has of wanting to say that particular thing or speak that certain thing. And all of this happens in a kind of, this is part of the second point, all of this happens in a kind of dialectic within the artist. There's a kind of back and forth inner dialogue that happens between conscious effort interplaying with unconscious or intuitive effort. A kind of mysterious, indescribable process by which the artist takes something invisible that's going on inside and makes it visible. So in Kierkegaardian terms, this is a manifestation of deep subjectivity. All the resident good, evil, finiteness, ignorance, and the wired in, at the same time, imago Dei, the wired in image of God, all that stuff is at work in a mysterious, sort of almost inarticulatable manner. What the artist believes about reality, or the questions about reality, the human condition, the mind and the body, all that shows up in the artist's body of work. And that, I want to make a point of that. There's no one single piece of art that always contains what's going on in that artist or for that artist in his or her pursuit of making art. It's the body of work over time and that really tells the story about what this artist is trying to say and the direction of the of that person's life and their vision of life that lies deep within. If you ask any writer or artist or musician or playwright or dancer, they will tell you, I know a great deal about the development of a particular piece of art, but they will still say, how did I do it? It's kind of like what Jack was saying with Bible study. You know, you arrive at certain kinds of conclusions and sometimes you're not really sure how you got there. But the conclusion is so obvious. It's so clear. Robert Henri argues, a real artist's work is always a surprise to him or her. It's a very strange thing. So art is unique from normal propositional speaking or communicating because once it exists independently of the artist, just one more point here, once an art piece, art is also different and unique from normal propositional speaking and discourse and communication, normal kind of speaking, like pass the salt. In that, once the art exists, once this thing is spoken and it's out there, what's different about it in language is that it's more open, it's elusive, it's a metaphor, it's exists kind of on its own out there, and by its very nature, the intention of the artist is to leave it. The artist definitely has intentions that he or she puts into it, and if you are able to get the artist to talk about that, you can get there with the artist. But as often as not, just by the very nature of the art is such that when you put it out there, it has a life of its own. And you're going to bring your own history, your own experiences, your own joys and tragedies to a particular piece of art. And the significance or the impact of that will read against and within your background, your experience, what you've experienced. So it's a little bit different than when we think about normal human language and authorial intent as we're taking down on a text, I would argue. So what does this process look like? And I'll just close with a couple of things here. What does this process look like? I'll go back to my little drawing board here. So I'm engaging in trying to draw a picture of what this process might look like. And this is just a shot at it here. You have the maker or the artist notified by the PBS man. And this artist, this person, has a reservoir of experience and thought and beliefs that are both conscious and unconscious or subterranean. That's all loaded into this artist. And then you have an occasion where the artist, something, an event, a time, a season, a point where the artist is going to actually engage in making the art. And the artist starts with an idea or a concept. So there's always this beginning point. Sometimes it's something you've been stewing on for a long time. Sometimes it's just an image that pops into your head. Sometimes if you're out there taking in, like a photographer does certain things, you find something you want to shoot, you want to do some photography of, whatever it is. You start somewhere and you make something and it takes a particular form, an image. And I'm saying by that a mark, a visible mark or an object or a sound or something like that. And then once that thing exists, there begins a process. And the process is one of reflection on what now exists. And the reflection is both conscious and cognitive, and it is also intuitive. Because sometimes you'll sit and stare or think, or whatever, in my case it's visual art, and you'll look at something for literally for an hour, wondering what's going on, what's the next move, where is this going, what is this about? You got something, now where does it go? And it seems to me that it's a back and forth. The next step is a revision or an edit, and then it's back to reflection. Again, intuitive, analytical, both cognitive, intellectual intelligence, conscious intelligence, and a kind of intuitive perceptive perception of what's going on, and then back to a revision or an edit. And this process just goes on and on and on. I have paintings that I still am working on, and I've had them for 3 or 4 years. I'm sure that's the case with writers, composers. But the process looks something like this, it seems to me. And then when you come to the finish, it seems to me you arrive, the artist arrives somewhere where there is a major critical assessment. A critical assessment that often happens at first in an intuitive resting. You sort of rest and say, boy, this is clicking. This, I think I'm done. I'm almost done. And then this is where the conversation with the dialogue of the history with the medium, with your mastery of the medium, all of that then comes to bear in this critical assessment of whether you're done or not, or have you said what you want to say. Now, along the way, it could easily have gone off in a direction you didn't expect, you didn't anticipate. That you'll hear a lot, all the time. In fact, I would argue that most of the artists, writers, poets, etc., that I've talked with, when they engage in a process and come to a conclusion, they will tell you 99% of the time, if not all the time, that it always ends up in a place where they didn't expect. That's the surprise. And that happens not only with crazy people like me that work in a rather abstract kind of symbolic back and forth between figural abstraction, symbolic kind of work, and someone who works with what you might think is very objective things like landscapes or portraits or things like that. These images in the process of making it always kind of unfolds, unpacks, and morphs and moves through various kinds of stages. Let me just close by showing you an example from my own struggles. Now, I'm doing this not because I think my work is necessarily worthy of your looking at. I'm using it as an example to illustrate what I'm doing here. In fact, my work, sometimes I think people really don't get it and don't like it. That's fine. But my point is that I want to try to talk. I want to walk through this just for a minute, and then we'll just do some question and answer kind of stuff. I started with this image. This is like art. I'm not sure why. This is a figure that is wax, beeswax on paper, and it's about 5 feet tall. And I was working in the studio. Actually, this goes back about 6 years. And I was wrestling with all the things that I've been talking about tonight. What kind of art do I? What is art? What kind of art do I want to make? Is there such a thing as Christian art? I mean, all those questions that I alluded to earlier, I was wrestling with, and I started working with a human figure. And this image emerged one day when I was working with wax. I was using wax as a kind of physical substance as a physical substance, but also as a metaphor for human flesh. And this is the point where the color blue emerged in my work as a kind of a color that denoted or connoted the presence of the need for grace, mercy, transcendence, the invisible. Again, it's kind of a loose term for me physically, but the color blue became very, very important in the work. Would you push the next one? Then one day, I was kicking around the studio, and I had this piece of paper that I had mopped up another painting with, and there was a bunch of blotches all over it, and I was staring at it down on the floor, and again, all this stuff was going on in the back of my head. All these questions were there, and I was asking myself, where do I want to go? How can I talk about man's need? How can I talk about man's condition? How do I talk about our need for transcendent answers, for the existence of God in a secular world? How do you do all these things in a visual form, in drawing, painting, etc.? And I noticed this scrap of paper on the floor, and as I looked at it, it looked like a leg. And again, I don't have my little pointer with me. Could you see if you could focus that just a bit? It's on that little knob there. Yeah, that's good. Back up a little bit more. There you go. This sort of horizontal leg appeared, and then this strange sort of black form. And I just drew it out, and then it just sort of stumbled around the studio for a while. And then I noticed one day that it was sort of like a horizontal body. Punch that again. And this figure, this drawing is charcoal and wax and oil paint, and you can't see them, but there are threads, blue threads in it that hang from seven dots over the body that dangle down, and the threads just barely touch the top of the body. This drawing is about, that body is about 6 feet across, a little less than 6 feet across, so it's a very large drawing. But this figure, this human horizontal figure emerged, and I began to look at it and think about it as a metaphor, that is the human body as a symbol of the human condition. This is another in that series. Again, all these figures are the same size. They're all just a little under 6 feet long. And this one, actually, this might have been the first one. There was this sort of almost a sepulcher kind of block at the bottom of the drawing, and then this figure sort of floating above. You don't know, is the figure rising out of this? What's going on here? Is it levitating? And it just kind of kept stewing in my mind. And then the more I thought about it, do another one. Thank you. These are smaller drawings. I kept working with this human figure. What happened in this process with this series of drawings for me is that this human figure began to emerge as a metaphor for the human condition, in the sense that, in a couple of senses. One, you don't know if it's dead or alive, and there's a sort of ambivalence about it that in my mind, in my sensibilities, stood for man, biblically speaking, that we're half alive and half dead. That we're alive, but there's another sense in which we're really infected. We're diseased with death, unless we get a solution. So the body, this horizontal body, became for me a sort of way of trying to explore that in these dark, sort of tragic atmospheres that I was creating, or different kind of atmospheres, placing this body into different atmospheres. This is a series of these. These are smaller drawings. These are about 30 inches across. And this is wax and oil paint and charcoal. There's a series of these. Now, each one of these drawings, I took this idea and all the stuff that was going on in my mind and in my soul and what I was trying to say about man and the condition of man, and this was all in the context of a secular, hostile to Christianity graduate school experience, and I was trying to find something, by a vehicle, that I could say things that I believed about man, about the human condition, and have conversations with. And but I didn't do that at the level of necessarily trying to be really explicit. This image came from the subterranean. It came from me interacting with literally the floor of my studio and the stuff that was on the floor of the studio. And it came out of that dialectic, in a sense, in me, between thinking about this stuff on one level and then possessing it at an intuitive level also. There's another one. You can do another one. It culminated, this is the last one, and you'll actually find this on a t-shirt out here in the lobby. this drawing is about not quite 6 feet across, it's about 5.5 feet across. And I had been working with the body, and it had kind of reached a place where I wasn't going any further with it. I was kind of reaching a wall where I didn't know where to go. And I was working with stains, and I'd been thinking about, I'm not sure exactly why, I was in Revelation. And the imagery of Christ coming as judge and victor on the great white, radiant, brilliant horse, this picture of Christ coming in judgment and on a great white horse came to mind. And as I was sitting in the studio thinking about this, it just sort of popped into my head. I had laid the figure down, the horizontal body down, and I had just been looking through some things, and this image of a white horse had come through the pages of it. There was a photograph of a literally kind of a portrait of a horse. And suddenly it just, as I was sitting there looking at the figure, it just hit me, and I didn't speak this to myself. I just moved. And the move was to place that white horse and the muzzle of that horse down gently and mercifully touching that body. And it was like what was happening for me was the transformation of in a sense, Christ and his mercy, rather than in judgment, his mercy almost as a white horse, touching the desperately needing, death-ridden body laid horizontally on this surface. It was really interesting when I finished this piece. And again, most of this happened at a very quiet, intuitive, non-articulate level. But it was very interesting, the conversations that came from this piece and the grad school critiques that happened in the next few days. I had more conversation probably about this as I explained where the images came from, and I was very direct about where they came from in my thinking, and the kind of questions and the kind of puzzled looks and the kind of response to it. I don't know how I could describe the response except to say that people seem to be kind of moved by it. There was something, some chord that it struck. And I think it was primarily about the human condition and this sort of strange, unexpected imagery of a horse, a great sort of transcendent and almost invisible animal. Breathing life, as it were, touching in some sort of healing manner on the body. And again, all that stuff happened way faster than I ever really thought about it. Now, all of this is to say, it seems to me that art shows our beliefs and the direction and flow and process of our lives, it manifests those things somewhat automatically. And I'll close with this. I picked up an article by a pastor in New York City that I really enjoyed reading. He was saying that C.S. Lewis once said that the Christian writer should have blood in his veins, not ink. What he meant was that if an artist sets out to make a Christian statement in an art object, the chances are it will not be art, but a contrived pronouncement. Rather, the believer, like anyone else, should first be passionate about his chosen medium, work in it, and let any message emerge almost as a byproduct. If one is a writer, let him be captivated by words. If a painter, let him be fascinated by colors and shapes. Living in the real world, being human, knowing about life and people, believing in truth, wrestling honestly with the troubles and sufferings that inevitably come along. These are the best ways to prepare to create. So my answer, or my closing statement, I guess you'd say, in my little talk here, or my little notes talk, is that art on the part of the serious art maker, whether a writer, a performer of some kind, a composer, a dancer, that it's like in James, it seems to me that in James, in the book of James, he questions his audience in the letter by asking them or saying to them, you say you believe these things, you say you believe and embrace this gospel, but I don't see it. Inferring that what they really believe is showing up. What I would argue, quite simply, is that a person who finds themselves wanting to make art or dabble in art or go more seriously into it, basically the vision of life that one holds is going to show up in the work. And there's a kind of, it's a very subterranean, intuitive, and critical process that you can trust. So at the intersection of art and faith, there's a sort of mysterious happening, but you can kind of trust in some ways that over time and over a body of work, what one believes will somehow show up. Okay, I think I'll stop there officially and see if you guys have any responses or questions. Or
do you view this work as a series of related images, or is the last one the final product of the revision and reflection?
Yeah, that one actually was almost the last one. I think it might have been the last one. This work here, I was going to bring some more slides, but I knew that I would do this going over, so I didn't. My grad school final thesis project, which has been, aside from some paintings that I've dabbled on the last couple of years, have been the last thing I've had time to work on. That work, this work, resulted in a series for my thesis show called The Will to Transcendence, which was a way for me to talk about the desire on the part of every human being to transcend themselves, to transcend this world, to transcend their troubles, to transcend their desire to be more than they are. And that series of work became much more conceptual. This was just a figure that I was using. That work actually took several different forms. One was a painting, one was a drawing that got me in trouble. One was a ladder. Some of you saw a ladder piece with a tree, a little shrub that was in it that I showed once, I think, in the gallery at the college. So it was a different, a much more sort of conceptual show. But the answer to the question is this was pretty much the last of that series. I may resurrect that body, though. Anybody else?
I have as much artistic talent in my little toe as a rock, and if you move to the rest of my body, it doesn't get any better. But so my question is, as a consumer, but as a consumer of art, and seeing how art has affected me, I'd like to maybe, you know, not challenge but question that last quote about if you go into art seeking to present a message, it's not going to come out right. That might be, maybe going at it wrong. I would. Have you seen Mel Gibson's Signs? Okay.
Seems like I should have. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I did.
Anyway, the Christians have a big problem with it, and it, from talking to them, it always comes down to the problem that I had with it, is that it portrays a man, a Catholic priest, who really is reacting with hatred, a vehement hatred.
Oh yes, I did see that.
God.
Yes, I did see that. Yeah, it's coming back now.
That's just one quote-unquote secular movie that seems to confront the darkness rather than celebrating the darkness that most of them do. And in my own case, the reason I didn't like the movie, that scene where he looks up and he says, "I hate you." I had to sublimate that, try to push it down, get it out of my mind as much as I was pushing down my hatred for God. And after I had dealt with my hatred for God, then I was able to see it and really see it for what it was. And he was trying to present a message. My wife is in love with Mel Gibson, so I know a little bit about his life.
Yeah.
And he was presenting a message there.
Yeah, I guess what I would say in response is that the finished product that you saw, I mean, this is off the top, but the finished product that you saw was actually a result of the kind of process that I described here. So art can have, and very often fine art does have a very, can have a very clear kind of message that the artist is intending, but oftentimes the message that shows up arrives in a rather strange, intuitive, subterranean kind of manner.
That brings me to my point, which is these handful of secular movies have always affected me much more powerfully than anything in Christian art, which I guess is limited to books and movies. Because it seems that Christians will not deal with their dark side. I think what put me on this train of thought was Jack's talk just before this, that if we do not take Scripture seriously enough to dig into it ourselves and really know what it says, then we will be drawn to the darkness. And what... You know, Scripture presents a lot of darkness. To use a trite saying, you can't present salvation until the person knows what they need to be saved from. And it might be that, you know, I am very stilted in my knowledge of Christian art, but do you think that might be the problem rather than going for a message? We're not presenting the gospel truly. We're not presenting ourselves truly. We use generalities about the world and about other people and about institutions. And then we talk about the love and the mercy and grace of God, but we don't really dig into the darkness and portray that and then go from there.
Well, if what you're saying is, I'm not sure I've got it, but if what you're saying,
I'm a dark person. I mean, you know,
if what you're saying is that art, that is, in Christians in general, we haven't been very real about ourselves and about our true condition, and we haven't been very good at portraying that very truthfully in the art that we do, then I agree with you. I think that we've often ended up with very trite kinds of forms.
Yeah. I think that might be the issue.
Yeah. Thanks.
It's my impression that when God creates, his ideas are made, given form exactly the way he wants them. Now, as an artist lives with the image of God, I think that's what's driving him, is his that creative force, that need to express, to wrestle with the reality we've been given. At what point can you say, this artist had no idea what he was going to put up there? I think about the guy that throws paint at the jet engine.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I think he's an idiot. Mm-hmm. He controls the color and the general area, but that's about as much idea as he's got.
Yeah.
At what point does that discovery process become bad art? At what point do you say, you have no idea, that's why your art's, I don't accept your art as being real or good?
Well, there definitely is some really trite, silly art being put out there in the name of high, fine art, and there's a lot of bad, elitist attitudes behind it. I think it's also helpful to, and often that's done, and there are people that do abstract kind of work because they haven't pursued the craft or the skills to do something representationally or realistically. However, it's good to keep in mind that from the Renaissance, I would argue, from the Renaissance to the 20th century, you really find a tradition that keeps unfolding that's largely representational, figural, landscapes, human figures kinds of, and you find it in different motifs and different styles and different personalities of all those arts. When you get to the 20th century, I would argue that the reason that strange art forms emerge, including abstraction, is because of the nature of what started happening in the 20th century. We begin the century almost with this horrible, catastrophic, terrible, unbelievable, unimaginable war and destruction. And some of the very first art forms that emerge out of that are in some respects, at some level, a kind of attempt to find a visual way, a visual form to talk about the stuff that in the 20th century is starting to unfold, so that I would argue a lot of abstract art, while it may end up being pretentious, some of it's false, the fact of the matter is if you examine some of the motives of the art makers, you'll find that there is not that they couldn't do the other stuff, it's that they were trying to find another way to speak, another form, another visual image, another kind of vocabulary. And while if we're not familiar with that, you could almost call it a game, in a sense, you know, in the sense of Wittgenstein's games. If you haven't entered into the game and you haven't sort of looked at the history of the game and how the game emerged, then the game can look pretty silly. And I would argue that happens sometimes with some art. But on the other hand, I'm equally ready to stand here and say there's some stuff done today and has happened in the name of art that's really pretty silly and at best and worse in some ways.
I want to ask a question for clarification about your opinion on the combination of artwork and then also what the artist has to say about it. Because when you're explaining what you had in mind in the process of your art, that's very helpful to me to understand what you're thinking. How important for you is it for art to stand alone as opposed to art being combined with written work?
Yeah, good idea. It's been interesting as Kierkegaard has become sort of the patron saint around Gutenberg over the last few years. And Kierkegaard talks about a style that he calls indirect. That is, the way he writes, he refers to as being indirect or even kind of poetic. And his purpose is, I think, that he wants to put the cookies on the upper shelf so that not just anybody can reach them. You have to reach them with effort. You have to reach them with engagement, with purpose, with a sort of commitment of some kind, of a sort of interest that is manifest. It seems to me that high art, fine art, good art, successful art is successful in the sense that the stuff is there, but it may not be easy to get to. It reveals itself in stages, as it were. And I'm not sure if this is what you were getting at, but for me, I've decided that if I hold my beliefs about the gospel, about God, about myself, about Jesus, about reality, if I hold those things deep within me, as I hope I do, as I think I do, then I have to trust the process that articulation is going to occur. And it will occur in some ways that are surprising to me, in other ways that I'm more in control of, or a combination of surprise and control, or surprise and editing and critical assessment and editing, such that I'm trying to refine the piece in a way that it doesn't necessarily become explicit or didactic or, you know, in that sense, but I'm making it the best piece of art that I know how to make. And I think that successful art that works, there's something about it that almost anybody responds to at some level. Not that's an overstatement, but so I just think that it's okay for us to put work out there that people have to work at a little bit, or do some homework, or talk to the artist, or look at a whole body of work, or somehow engage with, and then the reward is so much greater. In the same sense that, as I used Kierkegaard as an example, he asks you as a reader to imbibe him, and he knows that the choices he's made about how he wants to communicate himself are going to be more difficult than just ordinary writing. I don't know if that helps or not, but.